Okay, we're going to finish discussing theater tenets and theatrical amusements. We want to talk about apostolic denunciation of the stage and its vanities. Again, I want to point to Acts 19:29. The whole city was filled with confusion. Having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. We're going to come back to that in a moment. I don't think there's any real, there shouldn't be any real confusion over this point, that the reason the city is filled with confusion, one of the things giving evidence of it being a confused place is the fact that there's a theater there. We're going to come back to that. But the net effect of the theater is to impose darkness on a society. It's the very vehicle through which spiritual darkness and confusion is being laid upon a community. And so there, I don't think that it's any mistaking, again, the language that Luke is using here. And when we actually look at some of the specific things that Paul talks about, we'll see that I believe Paul's referring to this in his epistle to the Ephesians. And this event in Acts 19 is happening at Ephesus. So, we want to talk about why it's important that we have an apostolic denunciation, especially when we hear talk from some people that theater attendance is a matter of Christian liberty. And they arrive at that in different ways, but ultimately what they're appealing to is this idea that there's nothing necessarily in the realm of natural morality that is opposed to the theater. Now, I think that's a disputable point based on what we've already talked about, the nature of the theater and also the occupation of actors. I think the occupation of actors is based in a practice which is inherently wrong. But we're going to entertain the possibility, just for a moment, that there's a possibility of having what we might call an innocent theatrical amusement. And hopefully when we get done with this tonight, it will become very clear that the apostles, in some of their strongest denunciations of sin, actually had in mind the amusements of the stage as the epitome of spiritual darkness. So, why is the apostolic denunciation important, and wherein does it consist? Well, the fact is, and this is important, from the beginning, we need to understand that the Christian faith requires much more believers than a mere adherence to the law of nature. I want to look at Romans 2, 14 and 15 and compare it with Romans 10, 15.
Romans 2, verses 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another.
Romans 10, verse 15. And how shall they preach except they be sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of them that preach the gospel of peace and bring glad tidings of good things.
The fact is, the law of nature can't begin to get us close to the gospel. So that natural morality, And a concern merely for natural morality, is a sign of a religious paganism. It is, in fact, at best, a civil paganism, a virtuous paganism. But it falls far, far short of Christianity. Because we already know that we are unable to keep the law in its breadth and depth the way God would have us to keep it. In fact, all of our covenant dealings with God go beyond the realm of a natural morality. We saw that just with the giving of that positive command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the garden. So the fact is that true religion rises higher, even under a covenant of works. It was higher, it had a higher benchmark than simply obeying the moral law according to nature, natural moral law. So even if the best that we can say, and I would say that the best that anyone could say, is that the theater, that the theater might be reformable to a point where it would be in accord with the law of nature, there still remains the very real possibility that there is apostolic injunction against it. That from an apostolic point of view, it has demonstrated itself to be so corrupt and corrupting that despite all of the theoretical promise it may hold forth from people, we should not be surprised that despite all of the attempts over centuries, the theater's never really been reformed. It has always tended to degenerate, and any attempts at moral reform in the theater have been met with a large amount of resistance from that community itself. People engage in that, as well as it has a tendency to fall back into the same moral ambiguity and moral turpitude that it has tended to exhibit since the beginning. Now, the fact is this, that mortification, which consists in self-denial, cannot be considered a duty of natural religion. Fact is, it's only a matter of prudence and precaution. And yet, for the Christian, we're told that such has become duty. Colossians 3:5.
Colossians 3:5. Mortify therefore your members which are upon the earth, fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry.
Mortification is a duty to Christians. It may be useful under the light and law of nature. It may help forward a natural morality. But there's nothing in the light of nature or according to natural morality that would in fact make this a duty. And yet, the apostle is very clear. Mortification, self-denial, for the Christian, is a matter not simply of prudence, but a matter of duty. It's a matter of whether or not you are not only fulfilling the law as to its external concern, but that you really have all of your interior or internal affections kept in order. Now, one reason people, I think, find this such a difficult topic is because they have trouble with mortification. If you were actively mortifying sin, you wouldn't be courting it through theatrical amusements. But we'll come back to that. Thus then, though it were the case that the stage and theatrical amusements were the most innocent and harmless diversion in the world, it may be the case due to its abuse, it may become the subject of a divine prohibition. And we can see that in 1 Corinthians 7:31 and 9:18.
1 Corinthians 7, verse 31. And they that use this world as not abusing it, for the fashion of this world passeth away.
1 Corinthians 9:18. What is my reward then? Verily that when I preach the gospel, I may make the gospel of Christ without charge, that I abuse not my power in the gospel.
The abuse of of anything lawful can bring it under a prohibition. It can cause there to be reservation. It can cause there to be a problem. So we have to remember that whatever might be said about the theater, in theory, whatever we can say about theatrical amusements, theoretically, all of that means nothing if, in fact, the reality of it is, as in fact it has been, characterized by moral depravity. As I've noted before, actors and actresses by far tend to be among the most depraved examples of humanity walking the face of the earth. Their entertainments that they're churning out are inflaming themselves and inflaming others. There's no mistaking as to what it is in reality, in practice. Whatever we might say about it in theory, the fact that people are talking about reforming it and bringing some kind of moral reformation, some kind of moral whitewashing to what's going on. The very fact that people talk that way, the very fact, for example, that we need a rating system, the very fact that that rating system becomes less and less reliable all the time shows you the tendency. You know, they're reaching for more and more what they would call tools so that, for example, parents can have better control. You know, they've gone to rating television shows now. Why are they doing this? Well, the very fact that they feel the need to do this is telling you they already know they have a problem. You know, there's no unobjectionable institution in motion here, in effect. And they're aware of it. Of course, the result of rating, as a result of rating, what it tends to do is it allows those who are going to be depraved to be more depraved. They're told how many times they can blaspheme, how much lewd and lascivious content they can have in order to get this or that rating. You know, they'll push it to the limit. They do it all the time. So it doesn't really matter. It's no argument, therefore, that stage plays and theatrical amusements cannot be condemned by the gospel, because when well reformed, they would contain nothing contrary to natural morality or good reason. It doesn't really matter what they could be or would be or should be. We have to do with what they are. Look at, just as a point of comparison, 2 Kings 18:4.
2 Kings 18, verse 4. He removed the high places and brake their images and cut down the groves and break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days, the children of Israel did burn incense to it, and he called it Nehushtan.
Yeah, let's take the example of the brazen serpent. God commanded Moses to make it. Any that looked upon it would be healed from the fiery serpents that were biting them in the desert. And yet, despite its divine origin, or origin in the divine command, this is the best example. You know, And I don't think theater can appeal to having a divine command. But we have a brazen serpent. And yet, by reason of its abuse, people burning incense, they don't simply say, let's reform it. They destroy it. There comes a point when something becomes so misused and abused that the only answer for it is, let's destroy it. Well, this is precisely why, from the inception of the Christian church, I believe they've been so keen on destroying the theater. It's had centuries before the church ever existed, that is, the Christian church, ever existed, to prove that it was reformable, that it was amenable to some kind of proper use in conjunction with and in servitude, even to natural morality and good reason. It's proven itself to be resistant inside and out again and again. The answer is sometimes things simply need to be gotten rid of permanently. Furthermore, we should keep in mind this. When we start looking at this about the apostles, whatever they're talking about when they talk about the theater as an institution, there is no doubt and should be no doubt in your mind that it was and is a sin to attend sinful plays and theatrical amusements, even in apostolic times. Look at James 4:17.
James 4:17, therefore to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin.
Yeah. If it would be one thing if the apostle said, stay away from sinful theatrical amusements. But as we're going to see, there are several terms that are used to describe the amusements of the stage. And there is no attempt to distinguish here between what people today would like to say a good and lawful use, you know, family-friendly programming versus the institution as a whole. And I think that also stands as a condemnation to the institution, not just simply to certain manifestations of it. It would have been very easy for them to have said, stay away from this or that kind of thing. But when they bring in the language, just like when they bring in the language of the actor, they use that word hypocrite uniformly in a bad way, with bad connotations. That tells us there's something inherently wrong with that as an occupation, that as an aspiration, that as a vocation. The apostles saw something wrong in this. And now we want to look at this with respect to the stage itself. Not just what the theater was meant to be, not just the condemnation of the actors, but now we want to see that the apostles condemn the theater as an institution in toto. So first, it appears that the Apostle Paul declares against the stage and its amusements in his epistle to the Ephesians. If we look at Ephesians 5:1-17.
Ephesians 5:1-17. Be therefore followers of God as dear children, and walk in love as Christ also hath loved us, and hath given himself for us an offering and sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you, as becometh saints, neither filthiness nor foolish talking nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks. For this ye know, that no whoremonger nor unclean person nor covetous man who is an adult, an idolater, hath any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and of God. Let no man deceive you with vain words, for because of these things cometh the wrath of God upon the children of disobedience. Be not ye therefore partakers with them, for ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light, for the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness and righteousness and truth, proving what is acceptable unto the Lord, and have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them.
Okay, so Paul's writing to Ephesus. And Ephesus is the site of the theater mentioned in the book of Acts. We look at Acts 19, 17, and then 27 to 31.
Acts 19, verse 17. And this was known to all the Jews and Greeks also dwelling at Ephesus, and fear fell on them all, and the name of the Lord Jesus was magnified. And verses 27 through 31. So that not only this our craft is in danger to be set at naught, but also that the temple of the great goddess Diana should be despised, and her magnificence should be destroyed, whom all Asia and the world worshipeth. And when they heard these sayings, they were full of wrath, and cried out, saying, Great is Diana of the Ephesians. And the whole city was filled with confusion, and having caught Gaius and Aristarchus, men of Macedonia, Paul's companions in travel, they rushed with one accord into the theater. And when Paul would have entered in unto the people, the disciples suffered him not. And certain of the chief of Asia, which were his friends, sent unto him, desiring him that he would not adventure himself into the theater.
So Paul's writing to the Ephesians. The Ephesians are where we know they have this big theater. We know there's confusion there when the gospel comes. It's caused a huge clash of culture. And it's resulted in this street fight, which has ended in grabbing some of the people who are preaching and dragging them into the theater to make a spectacle of them. This is a city, this is the context into which Paul is sending his epistle to the Ephesians. So, with that in mind, we need to look at those words he uses in Ephesians 5. First, filthiness. The Greek word is aiskrates, and it refers to any improper or indecorous conduct in action or word, or even thought or intent. It's anything that is outside of the realm of decorum. It's anything improper. And it's not simply improper, as they say, in action or word, but even thought and intent. It extends beyond what we see done or hear, but even to that which it is eliciting. We need to keep that in mind because we're going to come back to that momentarily. It's an important concept. I think if you recall some of the things said already about the theater, that presents a problem. Foolish talking. Morologia refers to any speech which betrays that a person is foolish. Anything that demonstrates the folly. And finally, jesting. The word is eutrapelia. And that refers to any facetious or coarse wittiness or ribaldry, which is designed to provoke laughter. Now, why are these three terms important? Well, these three terms are condemning, in essence, the dialogues of the dramas, the tragedies, and the comedies of the theater as exist in the times of the apostles. He's using three terms that have reference to that. We want to look at Colossians 3:8.
Colossians 3, verse 8. But now you also put off all these: anger, wrath, malice, blasphemy, filthy communication out of your mouth.
The fact is that filthy communication, improper or indecorous conduct, the dramas are full of that. The tragedies are full of foolish talking. Tragedies have to do with people who are caught between the fates, if you will. Their lives are suspended in some feud between the gods. And jesting, well, that really takes in all of the comedies. Of course, there's ribaldry. It's designed to get guttural laughing. And a great modern example that a lot of people think of as being unobjectionable, but would be actually comprehended in this jesting, would be the sort of thing you see with something like the Three Stooges, where they're hitting one another, poking one another in their eyes. There were things that were put on when I was a kid on television that were put on and put out as if they were unobjectionable. And yet, in terms of the definition of this jesting, they are wholly objectionable. The contrary to that, the dialogue is designed to get and provoke a belly laugh. It's designed to elicit a response which is contrary to the virtues that are really the fruit of the Spirit that the apostle is enjoining. Several places that Christians should study. We see from this then that the apostle is not recognizing some division between venial and mortal sins. He's not looking at this stage as being lesser because it's somehow, it's not really serious, you know, it's only murder on stage. It's not in reality. It's only uncleanness that they're acting. It's only coarseness that they're engaged in for play purposes or play acting. He doesn't divide it between venial and mortal. The apostle was not a Roman Catholic. He's sweeping away the dramas, the tragedies, and the comedies of the stage, in these words, with that very same prohibition by which he condemns actual uncleanness. And that becomes clear again if we just focus on Ephesians 5, 3, and 4.
Ephesians 5, 3, and 4. But fornication and all uncleanness or covetousness, let it not be once named among you as becometh saints. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks.
Yeah, the terms, again, the apostle ties these stage dialogues, these spectacles of the stage, he ties them in with fornication and uncleanness. He lists them right up there with idolatry. He's not making that distinction that people would like to make today. You know, this is real and that's not. Or this is serious and that's not so serious. It's one list. It's like saying that just because, you know, breaking the 10th commandment isn't as serious as breaking the first commandment, breaking the 10th commandment is venial. You break the commandments of God, they're mortal. Wages of sin is death. Indeed, the word translated jesting, again, eutrapelia, is a word which signifies the buffooneries of the stage. And it is only used in early Christian literature in a bad sense. Just like the word hypocrite. You're not going to find early Christians, New Testament or early Christian literature, ever using it in a sense where you would come away and say, oh, well, that might be all right. Perhaps if I engage in that, everything will go fine. No, it's uniformly bad. Now, just as public stews or whorehouses are condemned not by name, you know, the Bible never says, don't go to a whorehouse. But by virtue of the law forbidding fornication and uncleanness, for example, in Acts 15:20,
Acts 15, verse 20. But that we write unto them that they abstain from pollutions of idols and from fornication and from things strangled and from blood.
The Bible prohibits fornication and uncleanness. That's all you really need to know. You shouldn't be going to a whorehouse. When the Bible prohibits the buffooneries of the stage, that's all you really should need to understand. It's prohibiting the theater. It never needs to say, thou shalt not go to the theater, if it says, thou shalt not behave like people behave in a theater. And it's a mistake, and it's a function of stupid, stultified American fundamentalism to think that we need to have an express command for everything that the Bible prohibits. That people who think that way show how narrow and stupid-minded they are. And I would rather be found with those throughout the history of the church on this side of this question who understood that the prohibition of the action prohibits the institution that would support that action than be stupid enough to think that I can support the institution as long as I don't support the action that goes into that institution. All right, second, it is certain that the apostles often mention the stage in a way of condemnation and forbidding. It's translated in our version by the words reveling or rioting. For example, in 1 Peter 4:3.
1 Peter 4, verse 3. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we walked in lasciviousness, lusts, excess of wine, revelings, banquetings, and abominable idolatries.
Okay, it's listed as well amongst the works of the flesh, which strive against the Spirit of God and believers in Galatians 5:21.
Galatians 5, verse 21. Envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God.
Okay, revelings, rioting, those things are listed as works of the flesh. They are, in fact, part of the works of darkness. Now, the underlying word for reveling or rioting is the word komos. And it refers to bacchanalian festivities, drunken festivities originally. But it involved theatrical amusements and often vulgar, risque, or coarse displays. It was the original dinner theater. Komos. They were the original dinner theaters where men were taken in excess both of food and drink and spectacle. It was all part of the same thing. You had drunkenness, you had gluttony, and you had theatrical spectacle all joined together. Now, from this word, And from the Greek word for song, ode, is derived our word comode. Comode. We get comedy from that. Komas ude. Comedy. Comedies, together with tragedies, actually are the two prongs which make up the entirety of the Greek drama. Hence, you've seen the pictures, probably the two muses, the one laughing and the other crying or weeping. The laughing muse is called Thalia. That's the laughing face of Komos, or joyousness. The other face, the weeping face, is Melpomene. It's the weeping face of the ode, or the singing. That has been the symbol of the theater from time immemorial. Komos ode. Comedies. Comedies refer to the whole of the theater. That's why Dante called his book The Divine Comedy. It's not that it's comedy in the sense of laughing, but it's a drama. It's a drama describing the eternal state of men. Now, comedy took in all of that. Tragedy, comedy, what we would call comedy. In fact, the original Komos ude were the original Bacchanalian song fest. They were the original musicals. There was singing, there was dancing, there was spectacle. And it's no mistaking, I don't think, that as soon as the movies were able to engage sound, you had what they called the talkies, that they immediately began to produce a series of musicals. It's exactly what you should expect. It is the nature of the beast. Undoubtedly, when they began, it was much more tame than it is now. But all of this other stuff hatched out of that. It's no mistaking that the entire stage, from time immemorial, has been noted by a laughing face and a weeping face, by these two faces. And I don't think it's any mistaking that the apostle has, in fact, pulled in this word komos, komoi, to describe what it is he's condemning. Thus, and in this word, the apostle takes upon he takes upon himself to condemn the entirety of the Greek stage and theatrical amusements of his day. 1 Timothy 5:20.
1 Timothy 5:20. Them that sin rebuke before all, that others also may fear.
And what is he doing when he does this? He's rebuking before all. This isn't a commendation. These passages are not a matter of commendation. The apostle elsewhere is using this word to describe activities of those who walk in darkness. Romans 13:13.
Let us walk honestly as in the day, not in rioting and drunkenness, not in chambering and wantonness, not in strife and envy.
Yeah, not in rioting. You know, all of this stuff belongs together. It's all tied together. Drunkenness, fornicating, komos, komoi. It's all coming out of the same pit. It's all tied together. It's all works of darkness. The apostle condemns it all together. Idolatry. You know, these original komoi were, in fact, pagan religious spectacles. They were engaged in a combination of promiscuous dance and this spectacle, which is why this word actually has application backward and forward to the two of these things. But it comes to rest upon the meaning of komoi. It comes to rest upon, in fact, the institutions of the stage. Now, in contrast to that, the blessed man is described as not standing in the way of such sinners. Psalm 1:1.
Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful.
So, the next question then, I suppose, would be, why are, and the last question we want to deal with, why are the vanities of the theater objectionable, even if they are, quote-unquote, innocent? First of all, it appears the vanities of the stage, and vanity, I think, is a good word that's been used to describe it, is vanity means it's nothing. It vanishes away. It has no substance. It's not really rooted in any reality. It's there for a moment. It's there mainly to change the way you think and transform you. The vanities of the stage are inconsistent with the apostolic admonition to study that which pertains to the glory of God and the good of our neighbor. 1 Corinthians 10, 31 and 32.
1 Corinthians 10:31-32. Whether therefore you eat or drink or whatsoever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give none offense, neither to the Jews nor to the Gentiles, nor to the church of God.
We're to give none offense to the Jews or the Gentiles. We're to do what we do, all of it to the glory of God. So we're to act in accordance then with this principle that we live and act to the glory of God, living strictly in accord with his holy will. Philippians 1, 11.
Philippians 1, verse 11. Being filled with the fruits of righteousness, which are by Jesus Christ unto the glory and praise of God.
We're called to glorify God. One thing I haven't really spent time on, some of the more modern writers against the theater object to the tremendous waste of time. And certainly there is that factor. Now you're to redeem the time. You have to glorify God. You've been given a certain amount of time. You're going to be called to account for every bit of time, whether you've made use of it or whether you've wasted it. Have you actually accomplished something, or have you failed? And if you've dissipated your time with the vanities of the stage, you will be condemned. You're going to stand in condemnation for that. You have an obligation to redeem the time. There's no in-between. You can't say, oh, I'm redeeming the time, when you're engaging in that sort of thing. It is inherently dissipative. Likewise, we're to live and act in such a way that we provoke others to seek the glory of God. Matthew 5:16.
Matthew 5:16. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven.
And there, I think we have to consider this. I've mentioned it in other contexts. And in theatrical entertainment, amusements, we have a tendency to have lots and lots of people sitting together, all doing nothing together, watching whatever's going on in front of them. Not only are we not glorifying God, but we're setting an example of indulgence and indigence for those who are around us. We're setting an example of spiritual laziness. We're not really concerned with the glory of God. We're concerned with the vanities of the komoi. Thus, then, the prohibition of giving offense refers to anything that we might do which would cast a stumbling block in the path of others. Romans 14:13.
Romans 14:13. Let us not therefore judge one another any more, but judge this rather, that no man put a stumbling block or an occasion to fall in his brother's way.
Now, there's really nothing that should be more clear than this, that the vanities of theatrical amusements form no part of that which is calculated either to promote the glory of God or the spiritual benefit of men. Look at 1 Peter 4, 3 and 4.
First Peter 4, 3 and 4. For the time past of our life may suffice us to have wrought the will of the Gentiles, when we walk in lasciviousness, lust, excess of wine, revelings, banqueting and abominable idolatries, wherein they think it strange that ye run not with them to the same access of riot, speaking evil of you.
Peter talks again about revelings. Revelings, that is, komoi. Running after komoi. Running after theatrical amusements. The time, you had enough time to do that when you were a pagan, he's saying. Wasn't that enough time to dissipate, to ruin yourself, to cast yourself off, to cast yourself into every kind of wicked imagination? Didn't you waste enough time? Haven't you given up enough of the good things in life? And haven't you ignored the glorifying of God enough? You had enough time when you were a pagan. If you weren't a pagan, you should thank God that you weren't a pagan. But don't give yourself over to this stuff. If it's condemned as a pagan activity, why would Christians want to engage it? The fact is this, the apostle warns against being defiled by a root of bitterness, which he names two specifically, fornication and profaneness in Hebrews 12, 15, and 16.
Hebrews 12, verses 15 and 16. Looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person as Esau, who for one morsel of meat sold his birthright.
Yet we can say these are the very things associated with the theater and its vanities. We see it; these things are all listed together in Galatians 5, 19 to 21.
Galatians 5, verses 19 through 21. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like, of the which I tell you before, as I have also told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God.
These are all things that run together. Fornication, profaneness, these are in fact roots of bitterness. And yet these are two of the activities upon which the theater hinges. Lewdness, lasciviousness, and profanity, profaneness. There wouldn't be a theater without the two of these things. There would be no institution. We wouldn't be talking about this. These are things which manifest themselves in the actual amusements that they produce and in the lives of those that are in fact producing them. Again, these people are a mess. You know, they've set an example in this country. They've made sodomy acceptable. They've cast people into all kinds of confusion and doubt about what to believe with respect to the truth. They've made a mockery of all that is right. They made a cottage industry of justifying all that's wrong. In their personal lives, they hold forth the example of the worst again and again. In their personal lives, they give us no reason to have any confidence that they are even touched with a sense of natural morality, let alone having concern for the things that are duties of Christians. They represent a culture and a worldview entirely opposite to what the apostles have enjoined upon us. They represent a world that is rooted in fleshly desire, excess, coarse jesting, lasciviousness, profaneness, a reckless disregard for the truth, blasphemy, idolatry, you name it. I mean, if we actually started to go over a list of all of the things that the stage is guilty of and has been guilty of from time immemorial, these people and this institution has done more to attack the truth than any other institution in the history of mankind. Why in the world would the church give them a pass? Why would they bother reviewing their movies and encouraging people to patronize this garbage? You know, people in the church are stupid. They boycott this and that at the drop of a hat for much less than what this institution has done to destroy this entire culture, to root Christianity out from top to bottom, to make what is absolutely unacceptable, even in a level at a level of natural morality, to be passable for good, decent, civil behavior. And the church worries about minuscule things and boycotts over much less than that. And yet, very few will stand up and just decry the entire institution and demand a boycott. The Christian church, the real church, the true church, from the beginning, has demanded an entire boycott of this industry. Second, theatrical amusements strike against the apostolic admonition to be separate from and not to touch that which is unclean. 2 Corinthians 6, 17 and 18.
2 Corinthians 6, verses 17 and 18. Wherefore, come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you, and will be a father unto you, and ye shall be my sons and daughters, saith the Lord Almighty.
Now, certainly it must be the case if the apostle takes in the komos or komoi of the Greek stage, then by uncleanness should be understood all the wicked practices and intentions inherent in the filthiness of the stage. Again, Ephesians 5:4.
Ephesians 5:4. Neither filthiness, nor foolish talking, nor jesting, which are not convenient, but rather giving of thanks.
How does this all fit together? Touch not the unclean thing. How could the church in any way give a pass to this institution when in its very constitution it embodies this kind of filthiness, foolish talking and jesting that the apostle condemns? Can't be. The institution is condemned when we condemn the practice. When what is necessary for the institution, when that has been prohibited, the institution itself is prohibited. Sin defiles the mind, the conscience, the will, the affections, the memory, the imagination, so much more.
Titus 1:15. Titus 1:15. Unto the pure, all things are pure, but unto them that are defiled and unbelieving is nothing pure, even their mind and conscience is defiled.
And we can say the same of the vanities of the theater. Look what Peter says in 2 Peter 2:18.
2 Peter 2, verse 18. For when they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through much wantonness, those that were clean escaped from them who live in error.
Speaking great swelling words of vanity, nothingness. Well, what is it they're speaking? Their dialogues have been characterized by the apostle. He's used words that are not unfamiliar to the world of the stage in his day. He's talking about their dialogues. He's talking about their institutions. He's talking about the reality. He's not calling for reform. He's not calling for us to try to get in there and make it better. He's calling for an entire boycott. Something which is that abused probably can't be reformed. Maybe, just maybe, the fact that the spectacle of the stage is carried out by a group of people who are characterized as liars, and whose chief characteristic also happens to be the chief characteristic of the devil, who is the father of lies, perhaps that should be an indication, just a small indication, of why we should find it so objectionable. It defiles the mind. It enfeebles. It actually mentally enfeebles you. Now they've known this for some time with theater, for example. They've done tests. They've known for a long time. They've known that it has a deleterious effect on the morals of people when they watch these things going on again and again and again. You say, it doesn't affect me. Well, that's interesting because the very people who are churning this garbage out in the 30s and the 40s did a bunch of studies and they understood that it did affect you. In fact, if it didn't affect you, they would have never rolled out the television set, which was originally rolled out to sell products, not to give you great sitcoms, but to sell product. They spend way more money on advertisements than they do on the dramas that you see. If what you see and what you hear over that medium and through that medium, through the spectacle, if it doesn't affect you, they wouldn't spend the money they do to sell you their junk. But they know it affects you. They know that it affects everyone. You can't take fire into your bosom and not get burned. It affects you. If you don't think it affects you, that should tell you just how far gone you are, how dissipated you really are, how far out of control this is in your mind. You see no difference. And if you can't see a difference, you should be calling into question your own moral judgment, not the moral judgment of the church from time immemorial. All right. Third, theatrical amusements do not contribute to the safety and security of the saints of God. Ephesians 6:10-13.
Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spiritual wickedness in high places. Wherefore, take unto you the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand.
You're called to wrestle, to fight, to strive, not to sit back and enjoy the show. If the enemies of God's people are putting on a show, and the show is all about how they're beating you, and entrapping you, and deceiving you, and leading all of your friends and family to hell. You have to be worse than a fool to think this is okay. This is what I want. This is not going to affect me. This isn't causing a problem. It's foolishness. Contrary to the apostle, these things are filled with dialogues, not designed to edify, but to stultify. Ephesians 4:29.
Ephesians 4, verse 29. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers.
The fact is this, the counsels of the theater stand contrary to the what the psalmist says in Psalm 1, 1 and 2.
Psalm 1, verses 1 and 2. Blessed is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night.
Can't say that if you're sitting in the seat of scorners. You're standing in the way of sinners. If you're setting that unclean thing before your eye, if you're meditating upon that which is contrary to the word of God, you can't say that. Fourth, its high esteem amongst the wicked should cast doubt upon its value to the believer in the sight of God. Luke 16:15.
Luke 16:15. And he said unto them, ye are they which justify yourselves before men, but God knoweth your hearts, for that which is highly esteemed among men is abominable in the sight of God.
The very fact that the theater is so highly esteemed among men, that should make you wonder. You should ask yourself very serious questions about whether or not it could possibly be accepted or acceptable. The fact that these people are paid exorbitant, obscene amounts of money to lie to you, and the better they lie to you, the more money you pay them. In other words, the more they train you so that you can't tell the difference between the truth and a lie, the more highly you esteem them by paying them for it. Service rendered. That's what you're doing. And that which is highly esteemed among men is abomination in the sight of God. You should find it highly, highly objectionable. Nothing is more plain than this. Sinful men are quick to approve one another in their sinful deeds. Yet none of this shall go unpunished. Look at Psalm 49:13 and Proverbs 16:5.
Psalm 49:13. This their way is their folly, yet their posterity approve their saying, Selah.
Proverbs 16:5. Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord, though hand join in hand, he shall not be unpunished.
Believers should no longer seek to serve the desires of the flesh and the unrenewed mind. Ephesians 2:2-3.
Ephesians 2:2-3. Wherein in time past we walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now worketh in the children of disobedience, among whom also we all had our conversation in times past in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others.
We should be very, very careful not to serve the flesh or the desires of the flesh. When we're doing that, what we're doing is we're strengthening that sin principle. We're enfeebling that spiritual principle. We are casting down the things that we ought to be building up, and we're building up the things that we ought to be casting down. If you're a believer, you have no business doing that. You have a duty even beyond natural morality. A duty to seek after that which is right and good in the sight of God and man. A duty that extends beyond yourself and a mere civil concern for your brother, but extends itself to a spiritual concern for your brother. Finally, lest anyone should think himself immune, there should be great care taken, knowing this, Satan beguiled Eve through subtlety and corrupted her mind. 2 Corinthians 11:3.
2 Corinthians 11:3. But I fear, lest by any means, as the serpent beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your mind should be corrupted from the simplicity that is in Christ.
Yeah, there's a beguiling, and there's a corruption. There's a corrupting of the mind. It's done through subtlety. That is to say, very seldom are people affected by something that strikes them as absolutely morally abhorrent. But what the theater does is it acclimates an entire culture to be willing to accept more and more that is abhorrent, that is wicked, that is in fact contrary not only to the duties of the Christian religion, but now we see even to the duties of natural morality. They are the ones, they are the shock troops of the new paganism. It is the face of the post-Christian world. It is, in fact, the new morality, the transcending of all right and wrong. What Nietzsche was looking for when he talked about taking everything beyond good and evil and a transvaluation of all morality. That's being carried out in our day, and the theater is at the center of it all. The amusements of the theater present a subtle avenue through which men's minds are corrupted and beguiled. 1 Corinthians 15:33.
1 Corinthians 15:33. Be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners.
The history of the church, three things have been at the head of the index of prohibition, if you will. Three things again and again, three things that even up into the Stone Lectures in 1898, Abraham Kuyper at Princeton, as I noted when we began. Three things. Lotting or dicing, dancing, promiscuous dancing, and theater. These are the three things that not only should no Calvinist cross, no one who would want to be called by the name of Christian should want to cross. These are three things that have been condemned in the early church, in the Church of the Reformation, amongst the Puritans, and even amongst so many of the better moralists in the Eastern Church and the Western Church, Protestant, and even among the papists. Do you really want to be more corrupt, morally corrupt, than the papists? You should think about that. It's the Christian Rubicon. Nobody should cross it.